Welcome to Special Content from Copyright Clearance Center. I'm Christopher Keneally. Over recent years, publishers have expanded and evolved strategies for combating content piracy in response to increasingly sophisticated counterfeiting techniques. The most promising ways forward involve collaboration across businesses, industries, and continents, pulling together the expertise of legal, content, production, sales, and marketing teams. For this first of two programs called The Never-Ending Story of Pirates, Global Strategies to Combat Counterfeiting, we will examine a variety of international perspectives across different industries. In a follow-up program, we will explore in-depth specific publisher experiences, illuminating how their organizations are responding to the ongoing challenge of piracy. Our discussion leader for both programs is McKeel Coleman, Senior Vice President of Information Industry Relations at Elsevier, a global information analytics business specializing in science and health. McKeel is a former president of the International Publishers Association. He earned his PhD in astrophysics from Columbia University in New York, where he studied with a Fulbright scholarship. Welcome to the program, McKeel.
Great to be here, Chris.
Our first panelist today is Emma House, the founder of Aurum Group, a consultancy focused on international business development and events in the publishing sector. Emma is the former deputy CEO of the Publishers Association, where she ran a number of anti-piracy campaigns on behalf of the UK publishing industry, working closely with trade associations and coalitions in India, China, and the USA. Welcome to the program, Emma.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And finally, our other panelist today is my colleague Roy Kaufman, Managing Director of both Business Development and Government Relations for Copyright Clearance Center. Roy advises the U.S. government on international trade matters through membership in the International Trade Advisory Committee, ITAC 13. Prior to joining CCC, he served as Legal Director, John Wiley & Sons. Welcome to the program, Roy Kaufman.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, we are very happy to have all of you join us, and I want to turn the program over now to our discussion leader, McKeel Coleman.
Thank you, Chris. So welcome to our panel discussing focus and on global strategies being deployed to combat modern piracy. And allow me to kick off with a few words to set the stage. At the mention of pirates, most of you in the audience will conjure up an image of swashbuckling buccaneers fighting against the tyranny of colonial powers. Today, in modern times, pirates still exist. Instead of the blue seas of the Caribbean, pirates operate and exploit the file share servers and social media platforms. Instead of bounties of gold, they are pillaging our content. And instead of fighting colonial powers, they are now targeting publishers, authors, and institutions. The never-ending story about pirates is just that, a story. I'm sure all of you in the audience can recognize a good fiction story when you hear one. The pirates we're talking about today are portrayed in the media as Robin Hood characters, liberating content from the rich publishers with the purpose of equality, access, and justice, a so-called victimless crime. But today it is time to talk about the reality. Piracy has, and always will be, nothing than robbery at sea. And piracy of content, whether it's textbooks, scholarly articles, or monographs, produces no heroines. Despite the rhetoric in the media, free illegal downloads shared across the web by pirates do not benefit anyone. Our industry's transition within a decade or a little bit more from print to digital was truly astonishing. But with this accomplishment, we also made piracy very easy. What's more, powerful social media platforms have enabled piracy to be widespread, even providing a safe space for people to discuss how to circumnavigate our anti-piracy strategies. Piracy today is a global phenomenon. On a basic level, piracy leads to poor sales. It is estimated in a survey by the booksellers that piracy affects up to 25%, a quarter of publishers' profit. This is significantly undermining publishers in their key roles today. and publishers play a vital role in cultivating and establishing credibility for new knowledge, for upholding the values of academic freedom in an increasingly polarized society, and in providing trusted facts in an era of fake news. And today, during the corona pandemic, trustworthy information is even more crucial and important than ever. So what has been done so far to fight piracy? Our industry has traditionally taken a whack-a-mole approach, using the legal tools at our disposal. Take down notices and cease and desist letters. What we have found is that the pirates simply use a different domain and pop up somewhere else. 10 years ago, we started to tackle the consumers of pirated content when Wiley, an academic publisher, became the first when they filed a copyright infringement against the unknown users of BitTorrent, a peer-to-peer file sharing platform, in an effort to learn the names of the infringers. Therein lies the paradox. While publishers may be within their legal rights, ultimately, it's the consumers of the pirated content that enable piracy to continue. In 2018, the booksellers reported that 88% of the students said it was not wrong to download pirated papers. Sci-Hub, a site that hosts millions of pirated academic research papers, is reported to have facilitated an estimated 1 billion illegal downloads last year. And that leads us to the most important part of this conversation, perhaps, and that is the fact that piracy also kind of screams opportunity and innovation. Take the textbook market. There's exciting initiatives from Pearson and Cengage, trying subscription models, all new to them, and rental models. In scholarly publishing, we're seeing publishers working collaboratively to streamline access, to make it easier for researchers to discover the trusted full text content. And access is more important today during the corona pandemic, especially remote access as an alternative to traditional avenues to content cut off by the virus. In short, we need to both fight piracy, innovate, and educate, and we need to do this collaboratively across our industry. Today, this panel of experts will share their insights and experiences about how the industry has been responding to the challenges of piracy. So we start with Emma, and I'll ask Emma first to give a brief explanation of the current strategies which we're using battling pirates on the open sea of content. Emma, over to you.
Thank you, Michiel, and that was a great introduction. And there are a couple of things that I just want to reflect very quickly in that. And I think that's around the victimless crimes, and publishers certainly are victims of piracy, but let's not forget the creators, the authors themselves, whose income relies on being able to sell and distribute their content. And they're definitely one of the biggest victims of piracy. The other point I wanted to pick up on is how piracy's changed over the years. So piracy's been around for decades and goes back many decades of print piracy, from selling pirated books at traffic lights in India through to mass journal piracy in other countries. And it's still there in some countries. It still exists and is still damaging to some markets. But digital really is at the forefront of where piracy is happening now. And I think in order to devise an anti-piracy campaign, either as an individual author, as an individual publisher, or as a coalition, we really need to consider two elements. One is, why is the piracy happening? And there's a number of reasons for this. One is lack of availability. So consumers are very demanding these days. They want content in the format that they wish to digest it. They want it at their fingertips. They want it immediately. And they want it at a price that they feel is worthy of the content itself. So availability and access is really important. And if the availability and access isn't there, that's one of the reasons why people turn to piracy, either as a supplier of pirated content, but also as a consumer. There are others out there that want to make money out of pirated content. And that's where we see a lot more organized crime coming into this, where people really want to profiteer out of pirating other people's works. And then there's the ethical side of things, where we've got the copyright believers that everything should be made available for free, and people see it as their duty to provide that information for free. And taking into account those reasons why it can really impact on the approach that you would take to tackling piracy. The second thing is to consider is how. So people providing, consuming this content, as we said, print piracy has been around for a number of years and is very visible. So it can pop up on a street corner. You can see pirated books being sold on the internet retailers. It can be in front of a university. Print piracy is very visible and is often easier to tackle. You know, shutting down a street market can be a lot easier than tackling a social media sharer, for example, or a peer-to-peer torrent. So how is this happening? And again, even in the digital space, there's a huge variety in how we're seeing counterfeits shared on social media sites, shared on messaging sites like WhatsApp. But we were also seeing entire databases being pirated and being either given away for free or access to. So again, the strategy that you would compile depending on the method of the counterfeiting, how it's being supplied and how it's being consumed. And I think publishers have taken a number of different approaches to this over the years. Some publishers take it upon themselves to take action, or other publishers will group together as publishers, either in one country with different countries, or aligning themselves with other creative industries or content providers. Now, for me, there are three essential elements to having an anti-piracy campaign. And they can be divided into three buckets. One is here, as we can see, it's education. Education is really important. It's really important. So educating consumers about not consuming digital pirated content. And that education can take the form of the content could be flawed, it could be incomplete, it could be incorrect, but also the impact that it has on the creator themselves. There's educating governments as well. We'll come on to legislation and enforcement shortly, but educating as to what policies and rules and legislation content providers would like to see in place in order to be able to enforce their rights and be able to create quality content moving forward. Availability, we've touched on, new business models, pricing, making sure that content's available in every possible format so that you can meet the demand of the consumer so that they don't need to turn to alternative sources. And enforcement, and that is quite often a last resort. If the education and the availability doesn't work and you're still seeing your content out there being counterfeited, then enforcement comes in. And that can be taking criminal action, it can be taking civil action, or it could be something like cease and desist notifications. So there are varying levels of escalation into which we would see enforcement activity. Collaboration for me has been really important over the years between publishers in the UK, but also align ourselves with publishers in other countries. And there are a number of reasons for these collaborative efforts. First of all, education campaigns often work better if it's not a single publisher or a single author. So educating governments and consumers often works much better if it's very generic about the general harm that can be caused, about the general need for rewarding creators. Enforcement actions, they're expensive. They're very expensive. And coming together and pooling your resources often makes enforcement actions more effective. They can be larger scale, but also they can be more impactful. And quite often it's not one publisher's or one author's content that's being counterfeited. If you find one book, you're bound to find books or content by a whole range of authors and publishers. And therefore having collective enforcement actions often yields better results for everyone. Lobbying efforts, again, if you've got one single publisher trying to get the ear of the government to make change, it's unlikely that that's going to have a great impact. But when you've got a whole industry of publishers talking to government or even working together with other creative content organizations, then having those lobbying efforts can really have a big impact. Data collection is really important as well. Understanding what the impact is on our industry and talking numbers is what people listen to. So lobbying efforts don't work without the data. And if you can share the harm that it's having on your industry and the loss of earnings to creators in particular, that data is extremely valuable. So working together to share some of that data has a great impact. Sharing best practice. Some publishers that have done things alone or a group of publishers that have worked together can often share that best practice with others. And that really works cross-border as well. So learning what we've done successfully in the UK may benefit colleagues in the Arab world, which are suffering right now in a terrible way, that they don't know which way to turn. So what can we share around best practice that we found effective in our markets that might be adapted to their markets? And then collaborative efforts to provide legitimate access as well. So coming up with business models where competition law allows, and coming up with access points that people can really go and access that content in the way that they wish to, as I say, firmly within competition law regulations and where that allows. And some examples that we've seen around the world of what have been effective. So in the UK, we have an organisation called the Alliance for Intellectual Property, which brings together people like the Premier League. It brings together film, music, television, crafts, not just content, but also goods, to really look at what are our shared needs, what are our shared wishes, what are our shared lobbying tactics, so that we can speak with one voice. And having that impact really does help. And I know in the US, the Copyright Alliance does a very similar thing for US content providers. And in New Zealand, we've seen a coalition of creative organisations come together under the We Create umbrella to speak to government with one voice. So those are great examples of where collaboration can have a real impact. And this is an education campaign that the creative industries have got behind in the UK, called Get It Right from a Genuine Site. So this is consumer facing and really encouraging members of the public that if they're looking for content online, to try and find a genuine website to go to get that content. So here's a few snapshots of what this campaign looks like. Again, the numbers really do have an impact, and not only on government, but it can really have an impact on consumers as well. So collaboration, I think, is a great way moving forward for a number of those reasons, to really sort of like understand how, why, where, and then working together to address the campaign in various aspects.
Great. Thank you, Emma. A great name as well, Get It Right from a Genuine Site. Other examples on the educational side where you think, well, they really jumped out to you and you would highly recommend them?
On the educational publishing, yeah. or educating the public?
Educating the public.
Well, there was a campaign which we worked on with government, which operated in a kind of a cease and desist notification. So where broadband access and broadband providers were noticing huge spikes of peer-to-peer file sharing, then a letter was sent from that internet provider to the consumer to say, hey, we've noticed that your broadband access is increasing and peer-to-peer file sharing, we don't want you to do that. It had some impact, not a great impact, but that's one example of collaboration with the internet service providers to reach the consumer.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Let's move on to Roy. Can I ask you to give your opening perspective on piracy?
So I've got here some slides just to show a bunch of initiatives. Emma already talked about the Copyright Alliance, and it's impossible to fit all the great stuff on one page. So it's really, if you go to any of these websites, you'll find a quick link to the coronavirus responses and things like that. So Copyright Alliance, of which we're a member, really represents the entire copyright industry. So if you're looking in the US or anywhere in the world for freely available material, everything from education to entertainment to scientific content, this is a great website to look at. Moving on, there's the AAP response. So the AAP members, that involves book publishers as well as journal publishers. So what you would get here is a fair amount of educational resources, trade publishing, and materials such as that. STM, if you're watching this, you're probably familiar with STM, and that's really scientific literature and really opening up. This is for researchers, it's materials and data and other things that are most directly relevant. And then Copyright Clearance Center, what we did was we started looking at, again, remember our origin story of being connected very closely with users as well as rights holders. We started talking to our users and said, what do you need? We were able to take the, look at, first of all, what AAP had done and STM, and then going to both, open access publishers who might not be STM members. Also, since we represent a lot of news publishers who are not in either of those organizations, although actually some of them are in the Copyright Alliance, we started gathering up material. And what we did was we created links to things that were A, freely available, and B, COVID-related and professionally curated. So we had, those were our two criteria. And what we started to do was go to publishers, particularly a lot of open access publishers, who I think probably assumed because their materials were freely available, people would know that. And I felt that if they were to curate a little bit better, they'd have more users. So we put this up, and within a week we had thousands of unique users, many of whom from places like the CDC and pharma companies and the like. So this was really about professional content. So this was our first initiative. And we launched this within about 4 days. And then we said, okay, what's next? So next was aggregating the Learn at Home resources. So this was all the freely available materials, particularly for parents and teachers and others. Because as the copyright licensing organization for text in the US, we started getting a whole lot of calls from people who said, how do I use content? What can I do? What content can I use? So we started, aggregating this material, which led to this. And we went to our publishers and we did something. A typical new copyright license from CCC takes a few years to develop. I've done some in about 6 months. And we did one in a week. Now, for a lot of journal licenses and other licenses, work from home is just part of the basic license, for educational use. And then in the US, we have fair use, which would, cover certainly some, disruptive, spontaneous teaching activities. But, where you have systematic curricular materials and needs like that, we felt that there was a need for more systematic permissions. And what we basically did was go to our publishers and say, people have been disrupted. We don't want to charge them for it. Can we just have you sign into a license that says if it's your stuff, they can use it if they've been disrupted. And, all they have to do is say who they are and what they're doing, frankly, so that we know what they're doing, so we know they're not infringing. And we had hundreds of publishers, Elsevier, Mikhail's organization, one of them, just sign in to say, if you've been disrupted, you can use the material. Don't worry about paying us. We know there isn't a budget for this. No one was expecting this. And we created this license. So a very wealthy man by the name of Brewster Kahle, who's one of the internet multi-zillionaire type, decided he was going to take content, take sort of a specious copyright argument, something called controlled digital lending, and just take it further and say, well, I have books and I'm going to make them freely available to everyone, and call it a library. So therefore, people will think it's a real library. And really, it's just this guy, you know, taking books without consent. The Authors Guild has been very active in this. And, you know, the authors are the ones who are paying for this. You know, people who really have a hard time making a living before COVID and now, you know, are losing their freelance work and losing all this other stuff. And, you know, basically we have, you know, well-funded pirates, you know, taking their rights and making it even harder for them to earn a living. So I'm going to stop there. I think I've probably gone over time and turn it back over to you.
Right. I mean, that was great and very topical, of course. I would like to ask you a few questions. So the first one is, we've seen that the strategy of the pirates has been changing over time. And I would like to have your views, and I'll start with Emma, of how the strategies of response have been on the publishing side. Have you seen a change during the years?
Yeah, I think we've touched on this a little bit earlier, where we talked about how, and we learned a lot from the music industry, actually. Music industry, one of the first ones to really be hit by piracy, digital piracy anyway, and immediately went after the consumers of the content. And the publishing industry did that to some extent, but I think we did learn a lot of lessons about trying to go after individual consumers, individual students, and that tactic changed pretty quickly. And instead now, going after sort of people who are in this for a profit or in this operating on a large scale. Some large organized pirated activity can be linked to organized crime. So there's an even bigger damage. There's a lot more at stake there. But I think the tactics certainly have changed to, when it comes to enforcement, going after the bigger pirates, the more organized pirates, the ones that are causing the most damage, using that as a last resort. So where education has failed, where negotiation has failed, where collaboration has failed, using enforcement as a last resort. So I think that's been one of the biggest changes that we've seen, certainly over the last decade. I don't know, Roy, if you agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are also some specifics, and probably next week's panel will get into some of this. You know, when I had my prior job and we started doing anti-piracy, one of the first things we did was follow the money. It didn't need to be a lot of money, but if there was a money trail, you could always find a human at the end of it. So it was everything from, you know, large scale, you know, print piracy to individuals selling answers to, you know, answer banks to textbooks on eBay. As long as there was a transaction, you could find them. You know, what's happened now on the enforcement side, we see, you know, site blocking activities, things like that, which do have a fair amount of scale. Now, the problem is you can move the site, but it is disruptive and it does establish it. I think working with governments is another thing. In the European Union, we have a whole new set of rules. So we're going to see how all of that plays out under the digital single market. And then there are other business models. One thing, I don't think it's in response to piracy, but I think it would be a mistake to not talk about open business models. So, you know, a lot of science publishers are responding to use demands through funded open access and similar business models. So there are other business models as well as other enforcement techniques. And, you know, with open access, although it'd be great to have all the traffic to your website, you know, it does change the dynamics around enforcement and piracy.
Yeah, very topical too. I mean, here, I'm in Amsterdam, the Netherlands now. We just announced a breakthrough agreement with the Dutch universities on the
area. Congratulations.
Yes, you know, jumping to almost 100% and also embracing open science, or a new world we live in, and pretty unique actually. I wanted to move to another topic, and I think Roy already, you know, touched on it. So we see here today, because of the corona crisis, that both students and researchers and staff, they cannot go on campus. And Emma, any views from your side, what the impact has been on in terms of piracy?
Well, I think it's about the availability and the access side of things. And I think universities and schools have been very quick to react to the home learning situation and to provide access, working with organizations like CCC and with individual publishers to make sure that as far as possible, content can be accessed from the home as easily as it was accessed from the university campus itself and from the library itself. So I'm not sure how much of an impact publishers individually have seen on pirated activity as a result of that switch. But I do think that publishers and organizations have worked really hard to react quickly and make sure that students have access to the materials that they need in a timely manner from the comfort of their home.
Yeah.
Anything to add there?
Yeah, we see the same thing. So we are, you know, if you think of our main services, generally our licenses, if they are collective licenses, include digital rights. So, you know, our licenses allow home learning, our licenses allow home research if you are at a corporation. So you see a lot more remote use. There's certainly a lot more infringement. I hesitate. I think when we talk about piracy, we're talking about a specific type of infringement. I don't know if others agree. I think there's sort of infringement where, you know, you're violating someone's rights, but you're not doing it at scale and your motives are perhaps a little less troubling. So, you know, I would put something like Sci-Hub or the Internet Archives activities on the piracy side. I would put an individual teacher who, you know, scans a book and sends it to their students on the infringing side. I think there's a lot more of that. And I also think there's a lot of willingness, I think, in the short term, just as publishers are just saying, take it, you know, through our license, the education continuity license there that we've added. I think a lot of publishers and rights holders are like, you know, as long as it's reasonable and, you know, it fits the purpose, you know, we can tolerate it to some degree, particularly if these are people who would normally be buying the books and maybe even have the books in the school.
Thank you. So if we think a little bit beyond 2020, so what would you recommend publishers to do in the area of really effective strategies to fight piracy? Let me start with Anna.
Yeah, again, I think that we're talking about on an individual level and on a collective level. So on an individual level, I think rights management is really important and having control of what rights you have, what content you actually own, getting all of your contracts accessible and in order is the primary place to start. So knowing what you own. Surprising how many publishers don't know what they own and don't have the paperwork to back that up. So rights management, I think, is really important. Having easy access tools at your fingertips, like the PA's Copyright Infringement Portal, is a really good tool that I would recommend. It's available to publishers all over the world, not just in the UK. I would recommend having that kind of tool where you can do easy notice and takedowns. Access is another thing that we've spoken about a lot here. So trying new business models, making sure that content is available in formats, it's priced appropriately to the market, and that you're keeping up with that as well. You're not falling behind in that and continuing to innovate and continuing to reach the consumers. And doing your own education as well. So making sure that when you're promoting your books and your information is that you're always pointing to the genuine site where you can get that so that people know immediately where they can access that. So I think it's having knowledge, having accessibility and having tools at your fingertips to be able to tackle some of the minor infringements, but joining in with coalitions where possible as well. So making your voice heard when lobbying's happening, keeping track on data. So if your content is being used, making sure that you can prove harm to your authors and to your publishing company. So keeping a track of this and having the data readily available as well.
Great. Thank you. Roy, anything to add on this one?
So, yeah, you know, I think building on, you know, when Emma talks about, you know, knowing what you have, having your contracts in order, having the data, I think of everything in terms of having good metadata about what you've got, who your authors are, and what you can do with it. You know, it's, you know, what do I have? What can I do with it? This is what you need to know. And if you know that, you can, you know, back to your three pillars, availability pillar two is really about licensing. And unless your metadata is in order, you're not going to be able to license properly. And that could be, you know, nothing spurs infringement more than someone's inability to figure out, you know, who actually owns it, you know, things like orphan works and problems like that. We can solve that by having better metadata, better ownership rights, tagging, all of that. I think, you know, and the other piece of that is discoverability. You know, it should be readily discoverable from a legitimate source. And again, all of these tie into good metadata. When you start looking at enforcement, and I'm thinking a lot here about the EU and the digital single market, where we're going to have this world where, you know, there's this sort of licensing presumption, you can license it, but also, again, if you can't license it and can't get the metadata, there's going to be a little bit more wiggle room. So again, on for whether it's for enforcement or availability, get your stuff in order. As far as education, I've, you know, this is something we talk about a lot. It is an important pillar. But I really think education's just about letting the people who are going to do the right thing know how to do the right thing. Because to some degree, we've been down this other road of, you know, someone who's going to steal is going to steal. And, you know, but someone who wants to do the right thing, letting them know this is not a legitimate source, this is a legitimate source. This is not how you do it. This is how you do it. That's the kind of education, you know, I think really makes sense and will always make sense. And it doesn't matter if you did the best job in the world a year ago. Now you've got a new audience. Now you've got new people. So that's what I would say moving forward.
But can I build further on that one? Because on one side, we see the battle against the pirates. But what we also see is a bit the battle to bring the consumers and the users on our side in this fight. So what else can we do so that the consumers and the users will be more on the publisher side in this conflict, so to say?
Make it easy.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Make it easy. You know, we started, you know, look at music, you know, as Emma says, we learn from music, right? So started with Napster, and no one thought you can come back from that because you're competing with free. And the music industry, has it really come back? Well, maybe it didn't come back to where it was, but, you know, and I'll tell you why the analogy with the music industry doesn't work at all. But, you know, to that extent, once it became easy, once you could pay a fee to have a streaming site, or it was just bundled in what you were paying to Amazon,
Spotify, yeah,
whatever. When it became easy, people were willing to pay for it. But it had to become easier. And that's what we learned from music. Where the analogy falls apart is, you know, I sometimes, you know, if you think of science publishing, people say, how come this hasn't been disrupted? And I say, what are you talking about? We went online in 97 before Google existed, you know, have been about making our stuff available and easy. And that's why maybe we haven't fully gone the way of the music industry yet. So I'm always a little wary about that analogy, but since I'm throwing in analogies, the last analogy I'm going to do is keep remembering newspapers. Yes. Hugely important for CCC, you know, after scientific journals, probably our next largest constituency. And, you know, they are struggling because their stuff has been taken, and you can call it piracy or infringement or whatever. Their stuff has been taken. They were told find another business model, but there isn't another obvious business model outside of patronage. So, you know, let the tech companies buy the newspapers. That doesn't really solve it.
Yeah. Emma, anything to add on this point? The battle for the user or the consumer?
Yeah, I think one of the hard things is you talk about being on the publisher's side, but that doesn't always resonate well with the consumer. Mm-hmm. So not making it about the publisher, but making it about the creator themselves. Mm. And I think one campaign that really hit home to me, it was a long time ago now, it was in the US, was a video where they're showing the light guys and the camera guys involved in making a film and saying, you know, if you download from a pirated website, this guy loses their job. So it's making it about real people, not about these fictional profiteering publishers that are often seen as the bad guys anyway. So don't necessarily make it about the publisher, but make it about real people, the creators, the people that have got jobs. I think that does have some resonance with the consumer from an educational perspective as well.
So final question, and that's about sharing best practices. So both of you have some recommendations how that could be done in the best way. How can you best share best practices? And maybe I'll start with Emma.
Well, I think in principle, sharing best practice is a really important thing to do. It's a good thing to do. In practice, how do you do that becomes a little bit more difficult. And as I say, in some countries like the UK, the US, New Zealand, there's a lot of really good forums of people coming together to share best practice through trade associations, through collaborations like the Alliance for Intellectual Property, for example. There's some really good ways of doing that. But I think where the assistance is often needed is cross-border. So through the International Publishers Association, I know that we've got colleagues in the Middle East, we've got colleagues in Africa, we've got colleagues in Latin America that are really struggling with piracy and don't know where to start in how to tackle piracy. And it's really damaging their businesses. And in times like the corona pandemic, where they rely on print distribution and don't have a strong digital network in the same way that we do, their businesses have suffered enormously. But at the same time, they're scared of digital propositions because anytime they go near digital, it's pirated content. So how do they create the availability in the first place? How do they come together? How do they tackle enforcement? What works from an education campaign? What comes first and how do you do that? And so forums like the IPA, I think, do help on that. We've talked a lot in other forums about mentorship. And I do think mentoring can be really helpful from one practitioner to another. So I think that's worked very well in the CMO space as well, Roy. And I'll let you talk about that a little bit more. But mentoring and assisting those that need it is a really great way forward.
Yeah. Roy, mentoring. Any perspective from that?
Yeah. So, you know, I just, again, back to the theme of I'm sitting in my bedroom, you know, how we share best practices hopefully will become more normalized, because whatever systems we would normally have, so with the collecting societies, you know, we would have an IFRO meeting normally, and now it'll, you know, I don't know, maybe it'll be on Zoom and maybe it'll be a lot harder. So it is a little bit harder and it takes more effort right now. But, you know, when we launched the, you know, our educational continuity license, you know, we did do so, you know, with discussions with other ROs where we could exchange rights with them and exchange learning. And a lot of them called us and said, what do you do? How did you do this? And so, you know, there is a lot of that kind of best practice sharing that goes on. And, you know, it's hard. The one other avenue I would say is a very good one for sharing best practices is through governments, because to a large degree, you know, if you think of someone who's a trade negotiator at a, you know, for, you know, a large country, you know, the UK, the US, someone like that, you know, negotiating agreements is hard. And they do it, and they do it really well. It is political with a capital P and a small p. But, you know, sharing best practices is something that's easy. because it has a little bit less weight of law. And, you know, I definitely can see organizations like WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization. A lot of times what they do is say, you know, I'm not sure we're going to get consensus on X or Y, but can we just share some best practices? And letting the governments know some of the best practices and supporting best practice sharing, because generally the people call them or demanding this or that. And if you say, you know, this would be great, this is what I really want, but if I can't have that, can we just share some best practices? So I do people to think about, you know, governmental approaches for sharing best practices.
I like that point, especially now that WIPO will be under new management with a new director general, Darren Tang. So exciting times happening there in Geneva as well.
Yeah, it really is.
Time is up for our panel discussion. But as the title of this session says, it's a never-ending story of piracy. And I think we have the opportunity to work together to really rewrite the ending. So let's keep the dialogue going. And I would say over to Chris.
Well, thank you, McKeel Coleman. And as you say, never ending. In fact, our program is just the first half of two programs. Coming next in special content from Copyright Clearance Center is the second session. Joining us to share how their organizations are responding to the challenge of piracy will be Sari Francis, Director of Content Protection Services at Elsevier, John Gary, Vice President and Senior Counsel in the IP Protection Group with Pearson, and Paul Johnson, Strategic Account Manager, OPSEC Online, which specializes in brand protection. And as we close our session today, I want to thank our program participants who invite you to continue the copyright conversation with them online. That is McKeel Coleman, Senior VP of Information Industry Relations at Elsevier. McKeel, thank you so much for organizing the program today.
It was great being here, and I love the program. Super panel. Thank you.
Indeed. And Emma House, we appreciate your contributions. Emma is the founder of Aurum Group. Thank you for joining us, Emma.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
And my colleague, Roy Kaufman, good to see you as well. Roy Kaufman is Managing Director of Business Development and Government Relations at Copyright Clearance Center. Thank you, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Chris, and thanks for organizing this, Mikhail.
Our program producer today is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Thanks as well to Rachel Martin, Industry Relations and Communications at Elsevier, for important production assistance. I'm Christopher Keneally with Copyright Clearance Center. Bye for now.